Don't frighten us by telling us the facts. 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 We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task with the same resolution, the same sense of urgency, the same spirit of patriotism and sacrifice as we would show were we at war.
For 91.3 FM, WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on October 21st, 2018, and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Rachel and Nate joined me to talk about the Brazilian fascist poised to become president and destroy the environment after we recap the country's past few years. That's all coming up on Arsenal for Democracy. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at noon Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me in studio again this week is Nate. Hello, Nate. Welcome back.
Hey, Bill.
And on the line from Idaho is Rachel. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Bill. Hi, Nate.
Before we get started, I just wanted to acknowledge we're recording this on Sunday, October 21st, which is the 50th anniversary exactly of the start of the radio station that subsequently became WVUD, which is our home station. 3 p.m. on October 21st, 1968, they started playing as WHEN, which is, but also presumably WHEN for Blue Hens in University of Delaware. I'm guessing that's the origin of that. And that was originally a station that just played, you know, like through the dorms and stuff. And it was pretty hard to pick up that station. But now we've, you know, over the past, like, several decades, but also specifically even the last 10 years or so, we've made big improvements at the station and now broadcast into, you know, bits of Pennsylvania, Maryland, New Jersey, and so on, and cover a lot of Delaware. We thank everybody for listening, and we thank the station for continuing to host us, but we're just kind of acknowledging that it was the 50th anniversary this weekend, and that's pretty exciting. And with that, we're going to get into the topic of our show this week, which is going to be talking about Brazil. Coming up a few weeks ago, there was the first round presidential election. Round two is going to be held on October 28th, which will happen before the time of our next recording. So we wanted to cover this going into the election. Brazil has had a bit of a bumpy situation politically for the past few years. Rachel, why don't you start off by telling us what happened in 2016 and what's been going on up until this current election?
All right. So in August of 2016, Brazil's Senate voted to oust Dilma Rousseff from her presidency following an impeachment process that had her suspended from office since May of that year. 61 senators, seven more than the two-thirds needed, backed her removal from office, and Michel Temer, her vice president, became interim president. And I'm getting kind of this timeline from a Guardian article, What You Need to Know, kind of a briefing, because we don't really get a lot of Brazilian political news. So Rousseff was impeached because of... She was implicated in what was called the Lava Jato or car wash corruption investigation. So this was kind of a clean sweep trying to root out long-term corruption in Brazil. It was also seen as a conspiracy to end 13 years of Workers' Party rule. So it started in 2008 and really ramped up in 2014. Federal police, prosecutors, and judges uncovered a multi-billion dollar kickback and bribery scandal at the state-run oil firm Petrobras, which was the biggest company in Latin America until this scandal hit. So contracts were inflated, so up to 3% of funds could be channeled to the three parties that previously formed a ruling coalition: the Workers' Party, the Democratic Movement Party of Brazil, and the Progressive Party. This probe widened to include other parties and other projects, including the Belo Monte hydroelectric dam. So the impact of that is it paralyzed the government because bribes were essential for building coalitions. And it also choked business because prosecutors ordered the suspension of contracts between Petrobras and its major suppliers, which included almost all of the country's biggest construction and shipping firms. And in more than 2 years, 61% of Petrobras's 276,000 employees lost their jobs, and many smaller firms that depended on that business were bankrupt. So in Brazil, politicians got their campaign finance funds through these kind of contracting with businesses. No single party ever came close to a commanding majority in Congress, so support was bought with cabinet posts and or cash. So it was all very hand-in-hand with business. This investigation was nationwide, and the charge was being led by judicial figures in the southern city of Curitiba. Most influential was Judge Sergio Moro. He became a cult figure for his willingness to take on the country's most powerful politicians and business people. Other prominent figures included Curitiba prosecutor Deltan Dallagnol and police chief Igor Romario de Paula. So they were kind of cult heroes, but some lawyers claimed their extensive use of preventative detentions and plea bargains rode roughshod over fundamental civil rights, including the presumption of innocence. Prosecutors claimed that former President Lula da Silva, an extremely popular president he was head of the Workers' Party. They claim that he was the ringleader of the scheme, but he denied breaking any law and says the charges were trumped up against him to prevent him from running for office in 2018, which ultimately did happen. Dilma Rousseff wasn't directly tied to this scandal, but she was a former energy minister and chief of staff at the height of the scandal. So, the prosecutors kind of tied her in. She had to have known what was happening, and she benefited from these campaign slush funds and failed to halt the corruption. So, and prosecutors also alleged that she tried to obstruct the investigation and protect Lula by appointing him to the cabinet. So, so that got her thrown out of office, and
which to some degree was sort of just a trumped up way of getting her out of office, because, you know, they were tired of these social Democrats in the Workers' Party running things, and like the business community especially did not like her or Lula, so they were manipulating events to do arguably a constitutional coup to push her out.
Yes, and this happened because Brazil has no confidence vote, so they kind of had to use other means to get rid of her. So after that, Michel Temer became the president. He was Rousseff's center-right successor. He was kind of despised. Nobody really liked him. He helped lead the campaign to bring down Rousseff, and then he named an all-male, all-white cabinet, which was the first time that happened since 1985, the post-dictatorship era. So in September of 2016, in response to global and national criticism, he appointed one woman out of 22 ministers, which was about a 4.5% share. And by contrast, Dilma Rousseff's cabinet had included 77 women out of 31 ministers, which was 22.6%. Also during Temer's term, he saw through an austerity measure that froze social spending for 20 years. I think it tied it to inflation. This spending cap was signed off on in December of 2016, and it was called by a senior UN official the most socially regressive austerity package in the world. And Brazilian leftists argued that it would damage the country's already fragile health and education systems. 60% of Brazilians said they opposed it. So at that time, there was this program called the Bolsa Família program. It tied the payment of cash benefits to poor families to their keeping their children in school and sending them to doctors for preventative healthcare checkups. At the time of the program's introduction in 2003, 12.7% of Brazilians lived in extreme poverty, which is living on less than $1.90 per day. And after the first 10 years, it was helping 14 million households. Then only 4.3% of Brazilians were living in poverty. So they reduced it to a third of the level in 2003. Oh, and also this program cost less than 0.5% of GDP through these direct cash benefits.
Was sort of the capstone of the Lula Rousseff-like program, was this incredibly popular Bolsa Família program. So, of course, the business sector also wanted that gone. So Temer had a counter proposal. I think they wanted to give out loans instead of cash grants.
Yes, exactly. So kind of a neoliberal alternative to these direct cash benefits. So that brings us to 2018. It's the election time in Brazil, and the Workers' Party tried to run Lula as the Workers' Party candidate. Despite him being in jail, he surrendered in April of this year to a 12-year prison sentence. His party didn't care because he's like the most popular politician in Brazil currently. And they really, really tried to get him on the ballot for the Workers' Party. Support poured in from foreign leftist leaders, among them former presidents Michelle Bachelet of Chile and François Hollande of France, as well as Bolivian leader Evo Morales, and 29 United States lawmakers, including Senator Bernie Sanders, who concluded in a letter, "The facts of President Lula's case give us reason to believe that the main objective of his jailing is to prevent him from running in upcoming elections." Earlier this year, the Workers' Party kind of had a Lula or bust strategy, and they had a social media kind of activist movement. They added Lula to their handles on social media. He actually led electoral polls by a wide margin. 30% of Brazilians said they would vote for him, and perhaps more importantly, 47% said they would certainly or perhaps vote for a candidate he endorsed. In August of this year, by a vote of 6-1, the Supreme Electoral Court actually barred Lula from running because it would violate an anti-corruption law that he himself signed. The 2010 Clean Slate Law prevents any candidate who has had a conviction upheld from running for office for 8 years. And he's actually the first presidential candidate to be barred from running because of the law. He endorsed Fernando Haddad for the Workers' Party candidate role. And he actually came in second in the first round of elections, but he trailed Bolsonaro greatly. I believe he only got about 25% of the vote versus 48% for Bolsonaro. That kind of brings us to today and the current elections going on.
All right. So, Nate, you wanted to talk more about Bolsonaro and some of his pretty out of control supporters.
Yeah. So, you know, just right after that first round of the election, the second round is the 28th, I think. So that's in about a week from when we're recording this. But yeah, there were a lot of reported attacks, especially against LGBT Brazilians. And there was, I think, around 70 reported attacks, like within the, you know, since the first round or whatever. And so, you know, a lot of these absolutely horrific stories are coming out where people are, you know, being stabbed in like bars and stuff just over political disagreements. There was a stabbing of a Afro-Brazilian martial art master, a capoeira. People had an argument, they were stabbed. There was people being run over by cars. There was an incident where someone was, I think, found with like a shirt on opposed to Bolsonaro and sort of taken by police and like locked naked in a cell. Lots of incidents of just people like being beaten on the streets or being threatened, saying when Bolsonaro takes over, we're going to start killing all the gays. So this kind of extremely threatening atmosphere has been ramping up, especially recently. And of course, going back to the beginning of this year, there was the murder of Muriel Franco, who is a black gay socialist Rio city councilor, who was gunned down in public with her bodyguards in her car. And she was sort of viewed as like a local hope for a lot of her constituents in the favelas, very popular. And basically people said it's like whenever someone has a situation where they can actually do something to change, whenever someone comes along who can do this, they get rid of them. So basically showing how this could be potentially an extremely dangerous situation. So yeah, I'm just looking at a couple different articles, including some translated from Portuguese, and just a lot of these different incidents where people are basically prepping themselves for even more outlandish violence. Like if he does end up winning, which it seems quite likely that he will in the second round. So I think we need to be prepared for that.
Have you seen comparisons to like Duterte and Trump?
Right. Well, and that's the thing. And, you know, I'm also reading an article here in Foreign Policy magazine. Jair Bolsonaro's motto isn't Berlusconi, it's Goebbels. Basically, you know, showing how because he also says stuff that's like Trumpish, but like closer to Duterte than Trump. So, you know, talking about like, oh, he said that he wouldn't rape someone because they didn't deserve it. Quoted homosexuality with pedophilia, extremely racist comments towards Afro-Brazilians, extremely homophobic, said he'd rather his son like would die than be gay. So, you know, he describes indigenous people as parasites. And Bill, you'll go into how he wants to completely destroy the Amazon rainforest. And that would, of course, affect indigenous people there. So, you know, this is, I think, extremely dangerous. And, yeah, you know, he's an open admirer of the Brazilian dictatorship, and as well as, say, Pinochet in Chile. And, you know, that's something that I've actually found interesting. A lot of the sort of right wing, you know, the Proud Boy types, and here they often talk about Pinochet, and they have admiration for him. They talk about the helicopters and the death flights, and they're very eager to reenact that here in the United States. So it is sort of interesting. There's a bit of this convergence, or, you know, the Trump people, I feel like they draw inspiration from them. And then actually there are Brazilian right-wing YouTubers that are drawing from the Trump playbook and using it to support Bolsonaro, and they're running for office as well. So sort of seeing a weird sort of internet convergence.
Yeah, here. You were looking up some of the stuff about the Brazilian right-wing YouTubers before we were recording.
Yeah, and basically they describe, like, they're trying to emulate, like, Milo and other stuff, and, you know, Breitbart and that type of thing, and they're getting into it. And some of them are running for office, actually. So, yeah, I mean, it seems like there's a lot of resentment against the current political class, a part of that stemming from the corruption scandals. And I think a lot of people, similar to how Trump, they just want to throw that Molotov cocktail right into through the window there, and they don't really care what the results are, but that could be what happens.
Now, one of the big themes that we saw in the news between the first round and next week's second round has been this theme that, oh, the business community reluctantly is supporting Bolsonaro. I mean, how reluctant is that, really? They seem pretty excited by the what the Temer regime has brought in, and the both Brazilian and international business community seems like they would be much happier to have someone like Bolsonaro win power than a return to the Workers' Party, which was very successful, very popular, and also moderate social democratic government.
Yeah, it seems like they were waiting for like a little period. It's like, oh, we're not sure. It's like, okay, then we're all in now. But also, of course, I think the Wall Street Journal endorsed him. So this is not just, you know, Brazilian business community. And the Wall Street Journal, you know, they have all this access to all the information. They're like, you know, well, it seems bad, but whatever. You know, more money for us, so whatever.
Right. Well, let's get into that more money for us thing. A big part of that is going to be environmental destruction. This is something that has been ramping up under the Temer regime and will get way worse under Bolsonaro. There was a Washington Post article that says, in speeches, Bolsonaro has declared that, like President Trump, he would pull his country out of the Paris Climate Accords, courting the support of the powerful agribusiness lobby, which is cattle ranching and soy production, as we'll talk about in a minute. Bolsonaro has railed against the country's excessive policing of its rural areas and forests. He floated the idea of combining the country's agriculture and environment ministries, which critics worry would enfeeble environmental protections. And he has long supported opening up indigenous areas currently protected by the government to agricultural and commercial use, which, if you know anything about Brazilian deforestation battles, the logging companies will literally just straight up murder like a dozen or two dozen or three dozen native people if they're in the way. And so when we talk about opening up indigenous areas, we are talking about full-scale massacres being endorsed by the government. There was also a Grist article, how Brazil's presidential election could F up the planet for everyone. That wasn't a particularly long piece, but there was an unpublished piece that I had been working on for The Globalist that ended up not getting printed that I was working on in, I think, July of 2017 or sometime. Yeah, July of 2017, where I looked at kind of the statistics on, you know, from a climate perspective, how big and important the Brazilian Amazon is to the overall environmental picture for the world, and then also, you know, what we've seen happening under Temer and how things could get worse. So just to throw out a few of those statistics. So again, most of the Amazon River Basin is within Brazil. The Amazon does span 9 countries, but of course, Brazil having the largest section of that. Half the land area of Brazil in 1969 was part of the Amazon, and it was 4.1 million square kilometers or 1.6 million square miles, but that's now down to 3.3 million square kilometers or 1.3 million square miles. The remaining area of the Brazilian Amazon is still about the total size of the country of India, which is just enormous. So that's the, you know, what we're potentially looking at, even despite that, you know, almost 19% of the forest cover being deforested between 1969 and 2016, which is an area the size of Turkey that's been chopped down. But there was all this promising progress that was being made under Lula and Rousseff's government because they, especially as their tenures went on, became more and more committed to trying to deal with this deforestation problem and recognizing that in the long run, it was much more important to protect this. They managed to bring about significant reductions in logging and clear cutting. The Amazon deforestation rate annually in Brazil dropped from nearly 28,000 square kilometers a year in 2004 to just 4,600 square kilometers in 2014, which was the final full year of Rousseff's tenure before the whole constitutional coup process started kicking off. And that was a decline of nearly 84%, which amounts to the difference annually between an area the size of Belgium being cut down and an area the size of Connecticut being cut down, which is still like a significant amount, but, you know, it's a pretty significant reduction at least. So we know that Rousseff was removed from power and so forth. Michel Temer brought in a controversial agriculture minister who was Blair Omaggi, who was one of the world's leading soybean growers. So as an individual, he's one of the worst actors from a climate perspective because rapid expansions of soy production under the new regime and before then had led to rises in clear cutting. In fact, Greenpeace had named Maggi in 2006 one of the worst deforestation offenders in all of Brazil, not just because of his personal businesses, but also because when he was the state governor of Mato Grosso, he contributed to nearly half of Brazil's total deforestation that was happening. There's also a program that will presumably be thrown out the window if it hasn't been already, which was an agreement between the governments of Norway and Brazil, where Norway was paying the Brazilian government to protect certain areas of the Amazon just to keep that like in reserve from a climate perspective. The new Brazilian environment minister under Temer, Sarney Filho, told the Brazilian government that rainforest protection can only be guaranteed by God. I would not imagine that that's going to get better under Bolsonaro, given the coalition that he's sort of assembled. And they had been getting paid significant amount of money, you know, $1 billion already, out of a large fund from Norway, and that's pretty much going to go out the window. And that violence that I mentioned earlier against indigenous Brazilians will ramp up significantly. But again, as I had written about, and as the Grist article had noted, there is a huge global effect here, which is to say that without Brazil working on this deforestation challenge, there is no hope whatsoever of stopping global warming. A return to massive clear cutting in Brazil would likely cause irreversible climate change emissions damage on a huge scale. That's why Norway had set up that fund. Again, the Amazon as a whole covers like 40% of South America, and 60% of that is located within Brazil. And so Brazil is the key on this puzzle. And it's one of the most forested countries in the world. It's third after only Russia and Canada. And again, we're talking about an area the size of India that is potentially in jeopardy. And you cannot do this climate protection without protecting the situation in Brazil. And again, Bolsonaro is just complete disaster for that. But of course, it's not just the fascists that are responsible. It's also that business community element, as we've seen under the Michel Temer regime. Okay, anybody have closing thoughts as we wrap up this week's episode? Rachel, I'll go to you first.
It's very worrying to see the rise of far-right governments around the world, as we've recently seen in Italy and in Eastern Europe. I guess the world is kind of waiting with bated breath to see the outcome of this election.
Nate?
Yeah, and I'm just seeing more reports of, it was a 19-year-old woman with a shirt opposed to Bolsonaro who had a swastika carved onto her by a group of men. So this is the kind of thing that's happening, and I think it could potentially only get worse if he does get elected, which I think is quite likely. It would be difficult for Haddad to...
The courts and the ruling administration have done all the heavy lifting to prevent the left
and
from
I think
having
Haddad would
here.
Need to get like 100% of all the other votes not cast for Bolsonaro in the first round in order to win. And that's probably not going to happen, so...
All right. Well, Nate, thanks so much for being here in studio this week.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks, Rachel.
And Rachel, thanks for being on the line.
Thanks for having me.
That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFD Radio or email AFDradio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from arsenalfordemocracy.com on Tuesdays. You can hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Tuesday at noon Eastern. Our theme music was composed for us by Stuntbird. If there are articles or papers discussed in an episode, we usually post links to them on arsenalfordemocracy.com along with each episode. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message.